feel physically. That's what's different. I mean, I feel. My body feels. I enjoy making love with him. Which is a very baffling and bewildering thing for me because I've never felt that before. I just wish that I could let things happen and enjoy it, you know, for what it is and while it lasts and relax about it. But all the time, I keep feeling the need to destroy it, to break it off, to go back to the comfort of being numb again. I keep hoping in a way that it's going to end. Because, I mean, I had more control before when I was with Trix. At least I knew what I was doing and I was setting everything up. Now I'd... And that's what's so strange, is that I'm not setting anything up, that something is... I mean, you obviously know what this is like, but I've never felt it before. It's a new thing, and it's so strange. The sensation that something that is flowing from me naturally to somebody else, without its being prettied up or... I mean, he's seen me horrible. He's seen me ugly. He's seen me mean. He's seen me hoary. And it doesn't seem to matter. And he seems to accept me. And I guess having sex with somebody and feeling that those sort of feelings towards them is very new to me, and I wish that I didn't keep wanting to destroy it.
In a tragic car accident, we lost one of the greatest writers, producers, and directors the cinematic medium has ever known. Alan J. Pakula might not have been a household name, but his legacy of landmark films will forever live in the hearts and minds of film lovers all across the globe. From his earliest producing efforts in To Kill a Mockingbird and Up the Down Staircase to his paranoid trilogy of Clute, The Parallax View, and All the President's Men, all the way to stunning dramas like Sophie's Choice and powerhouse thrillers like Presumed Innocent, The Pelican Brief, and The Devil's Own, Pakula's works contain a meticulously crafted sense of detail and never fail to shed light on our capacity for both corruption and great humanity. Tonight we pay tribute to this master filmmaker whose legendary works have enriched the art form and the lives of countless cinema enthusiasts. We start with Jared Brown, the author of the first definitive biography on Alan J. Pakula, titled Alan J. Pakula, His Films and His Life. This book offers amazing insights from over 40 close collaborators, friends, and family members, including Harrison Ford, Meryl Streep, Donald Sutherland, Kevin Kline, and Jane Fonda. It is a must-read tribute to one of our great filmmakers who placed the integrity of his work far above personal notoriety. Mr. Brown is the former chair of the School of Theater Arts at Illinois Wesleyan University and has authored a number of plays, essays, and books, including Zero Mostel, a biography, and Theater in America During the Revolution. It is a great honor to welcome Mr. Jared Brown to our program. Mr. Brown, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much for being with us tonight. We appreciate your participation in this.
Sure.
First of all, do you concur with that assessment that, you know, he's responsible for so many classic films, but the name Alan J. Pakula isn't very widely known?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, as I was working on the book, as I was researching it and writing it, people would ask me what I was working on, and I would mention the outstanding film director, Alan J. Pakula, and I'd get blank stares from a lot of people. And then I'd say, well, you've seen All the President's Men, right? You've seen Sophie's Choice. You've seen Clute. And they would say, do you mean he directed all those things? And I'd say,
yeah.
Oh, God.
Yeah. So I think it pointed to the fact that he really wasn't a person who was a self-promoter. He was interested in his work. He was interested in a lot of other things, but not really so much in pushing himself. And maybe that's why his name is not as well known as it really ought to be.
Yeah, yeah. And it's plus, in terms of his style, I mean, he made films that had very provocative subject matter.
Absolutely.
But his style was so encapsulated in capturing the reality it didn't call attention to itself. It was it was invisible. That's how good it was.
Yeah, well, I think that was partly the style that he was. Well, it was the style that he was trying to achieve. He didn't move the camera in a fancy way, for instance, because he didn't want to call attention to the camera. He wanted the audience's attention to be on the story that was being told, on the actors, and the development of the plot, and so on.
Yeah. So for you personally, what are some of your favorite Pakula films, and how do they speak to you?
Well, I would say Sophie's Choice and All the President's Men were his great masterworks. I've been asked this question many times, and I really can't choose between those two. I just think they're both great pictures.
Yeah.
I suppose there is no stronger emotional feeling that I've ever gotten from a movie than I got from Sophie's Choice.
Yeah.
I remember at the end of that picture when I first saw it, I think I was in San Francisco, and I was just stunned and sat there and couldn't get out of my seat when the film was over. And I noticed that I was not the only one in the theater either, that many people were reacting that way. It is it's just a masterful work, I think, and partly because it has great performances by Meryl Streep and by Kevin Kline. And everybody in the film is so good, but it's the overall conception and the brilliance that, with which everything is treated that is so great about it. And then, of course, All the President's Men, which is probably better known to many people. Also, fine performances from Robert Redford and Dustin Hoffman and Jason Robards and others. But it also, I think, really shed so much illumination on how these young reporters at the time, Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein, had exposed this tremendous conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
And it contributed to the resignation of a president, I think for the only time in the history of the United States, and created in the film itself such a mood of fear at certain points, of interest in the investigative process, which, and is probably the most accurate journalistic film ever made, I would think.
I think so, too, yeah.
Yeah. And it's also, as I say, I think it's just masterful. But if those two are the best, you know, I think that some of the others I heard you mention before are certainly very close to it. Clute, certainly. To Kill a Mockingbird, which he produced but did not direct.
Right.
Presumed Innocent. Really
how can you get better than any of those?
That's right, and maybe just a step down from those would be, in my opinion, the Parallax View, but very close.
Right. But in speaking to your all of his collaborators and friends and family, what surprised you most about him, and what were some of the most common sentiments that kept popping up?
Well, I'm not sure this surprised me very much, but here's a common sentiment, certainly, that kept popping up, that he was extraordinarily interested in psychology, and in fact, he had, at one point in his life, before he went into the movie business, he had considered becoming a psychiatrist. He didn't, in fact, but it seems to me that that sensibility was with him always, his tremendous interest in the psychology of his characters. And I think his great interest in other people. You know, I don't know if you're aware of this, but when he was on an airplane, let's say, and he was sitting next to a person that he didn't know and didn't know him, and the person would ask in the course of the flight, what do you do for a living? And Pakula would never say, I'm a movie director, because he didn't want to talk about himself. He wanted to talk about other people.
Right.
So he would say, I'm a psychiatrist, so, you know, tell me a little about your life. What do you do? And he loved that sort of thing, getting other people involved and telling him their story. And there, his wife, Hannah, told me this interesting story, I think, that they would have dinner parties several times, and when people would come over, Hannah and Alan would sit at separate places on the table, and the person seated next to Alan would come over to Hannah at the end of the dinner often and say, I don't know how he did it, but Alan got everything out of me. He knows everything about me now. I told him my life story. And that's because he was really curious about other people and why they behave and the way they behave. And I think that shows up in his pictures, that they are so psychologically complex.
Sure. I read an interview that he did years ago with maybe 85 with the American Film Institute, and he actually spoke about, you know, the role of the director is part psychoanalyst.
Right.
You know, and he was very meticulous in the way he communicated with his actors. In terms of his actors and what you heard from them, what I've often heard him refer to as a perfect actor's director. What made that the case with him?
I think the fact that he had so much respect for the actors that he was working with. As Meryl Streep pointed out, some directors find the whole process of making a film a messy one, especially because they have to work with these actors who keep getting in the way, and they just can't wait to get into the editing room where they feel the work, they can really control their work.
Right.
Fuller wasn't like that at all. He loved the interaction with actors. In fact, that's why he became a director, as he said many times, that he loved to work with actors. And he was able to draw from them such interesting performances, I think, because he gave them such freedom. They had the freedom often to improvise. They certainly had the freedom to explore their characters in many different ways. And Pakula was one who liked to take many different takes of a scene in Sophie's Choice that he said could have been done 30 different ways. And Pakula said, well, let's see them. And they filmed many of those ways, and they were pretty radically different. And Kevin Kline said, I've never worked with a director who let me have that kind of freedom before or since. Mm. And it was just a fantastic luxury. He said everything in that film came from the actor's impulse, and that's what Pakula told them. He said, don't worry about the camera, don't worry about the lighting, don't worry about anything, just worry about the honesty of your relationships. And I think he was able to draw that from them so often.
I know that he, growing up, his father was in the printing business,
mm-hmm.
and he was being looked upon to kind of take over that business. But
yeah.
But where did the detour take place? Where did his love of films come to play?
Well, I think it started with his love of the theater. He was going to school, and he directed a production of Chekhov's. And for the first time, he said he felt a real power in directing the play. He said it was clear that the actors relied on him and that he had a kind of feeling for the actors, and he could work with them in a sort of magical way.
Mm-hmm.
And he decided ultimately that he wanted to go into films, but not before he had explored the theater, both as director and producer, director on an amateur level, producer on a professional level. So he began by going out to California with his father's permission and his father's money, and he worked for Warner Brothers in the cartoon department with the intention of becoming a film director. And the deal that he made with his father was that if I don't make it within, it was either 1 year or 2 years, I can't recall, then I will come home and I will take over the family business. And that was a deal that his father also understood that Alan would keep to. Well, at the end of 2 years, Alan had really done very well. He had become the assistant head of a film studio. He was not yet directing, but on the verge of producing, although he hadn't done any yet. And he called his father, and he said, you know, I've reached the end of the time, the year or 2 years, so I'm ready to come home. And his father said, no, you stay there. I'm going to send you some more money. I want you to stay there. And Alan Pakula always said that that was a decisive turning point in his life. He said he knew his father really wanted him to come back, but here was his father being incredibly generous,
yeah.
saying, stay out there and do what you want to do. And, of course, his career took off very shortly after that.
Mm, that's fantastic. When did his relationship with Robert Mulligan begin, that collaboration?
It was on the picture Fear Strikes Out. I don't remember the exact year, but I think it was around 1953 or so. You may have some of the dates there, but I'll flip through.
57,
okay. And Pakula this was his first time out of the gate as a producer, and he was looking for a director. Mulligan had done a lot of television, and he had seen a lot of his work and was very impressed by it, and was especially impressed because he saw a production that Mulligan had directed on television with Anthony Perkins in the lead, And he said he found Perkins to be generally a very mannered actor, and he had already decided that Perkins was going to play the leading role and had contracted Perkins, in fact, but he was getting very nervous about it. And then he watched this production directed by Mulligan with Perkins playing the lead, and he said all the mannerisms vanished, and he said he was absolutely believable, and he said, well, now that's the director for me. And so he went out and hired Robert Mulligan, and so they teamed up and made a number of pictures together.
Yeah, and including To Kill a Mockingbird, correct?
Right. Absolutely.
And they talk about it. We talk about the perfect films that Pakula has directed, and producing To Kill a Mockingbird, which is probably the ultimate time vault movie of the 20th century for me, just a gem of a movie. But you can see, not so much in that because I see that as more of a human story, but you can certainly see traces of it in his 70s work, kind of a political bent. Did he always have a sense that they would play in a role in his art?
Politics
and social commentary?
Yeah, I think he must have. Certainly, most of his films could be called political, either in a broad sense or sometimes in a narrow one. He was a political junkie, as several people described him. He's very interested in politics, followed it very closely. And you could go down the list of many of his films, like The Parallax View, All the President's Men, certainly Sophie's Choice, Presumed Innocent, even The Pelican Brief, and say that these are all political films.
Even Rollover.
Yeah, Rollover would be another good example, yes. I think that Pakula had a distrust of large institutions, and many of his films express that distrust, I think, in focusing on the individual in conflict with large institutions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it seemed that the films of the 70s, here I go again, I'm on my 70s soapbox, but it seemed like the films of the 70s really nurtured that kind of investigation. And you see he thrived particularly in the 70s with those films. Was there a sense of that you got that when that era of filmmaking kind of ended, what his reaction to that was? Was he at all kind of put off by the Hollywood system and what kind of films were being produced?
Well, you know, he was never really a part of the Hollywood system. He directed almost all his films on the East Coast. He lived in New York. He had early on in his career been in Hollywood, but he never really liked it very much. And partly why he didn't like it, I think, is that he was concerned about being controlled by film studios, about being told, this is the kind of film we want you to do, this is the approach we want you to take. And, he really didn't want that sort of pressure. He wanted to make films that were important to him in a personal sense. So I don't know if that answers your question, but that would be my immediate response.
Yeah, I mean he still made the fantastic movies, throughout the 80s, Sophie's Choice and Presumed Innocent.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that the era that really catered to, I think, his kinds of films was the 70s. And I want to talk about some of these movies just briefly from the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And what commonly is referred to as his paranoid trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
This is Klute, The Parallax View, and All the President's Men.
Right.
And he seemed to have a particular affinity for Jane Fonda.
Yes.
Because they worked together, I think, three times.
Three times.
That's right.
Yeah.
What was that collaboration like? You spoke to Ms. Fonda for the book, correct?
Yes, I did. Well, she was, of course, enormously impressed by Pakula and working with him. She said that she is not the kind of actress who can work independently. She needs direction, she said. She needs someone to focus her on where she's going and give her ideas. And that he was, as far as she was concerned, the ideal director to work with. I think that their work together, their collaboration, really reached a peak in Klute. They did make two more pictures together. I think she was very, very good in Comes a Horseman, although the film is not the equal of Klute at all.
Right.
And then in Rollover, I know that there are some people who are fond of that. I don't think it's a good movie at all.
No, it's kind of ahead of its time in one sense. It's like for today, That's the only thing I could think of that you could say. Yeah, it was. You know, you could it could play today almost.
Well, that's true. I think there are things about it. I mean, you could pick out scenes or moments in the picture that are particularly interesting, but I don't think it worked very well. And neither does Jane Fonda, by the way. She felt that.
No, I remember it was panned when it came out.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember it was panned horribly.
Yeah, but starting with Clute, I mean, it's kind of a revolutionary role for a female lead at that time, wasn't it?
Especially for somebody who was known as Barbarella, kind of sex symbol at the time, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Something very different from her for her, and it really allowed her to break out of the kind of stereotype that she had been in before. And of course, she's absolutely brilliant in that picture,
yeah.
Which is why he wanted to work with her again and again. And she was, I think she's one of our very best actresses. You know, I know that she hasn't done much work for the last 30 years or so, but she's really very brilliant and incredibly smart, I think.
Oh, absolutely.
And her intelligence just shines through in everything that she does. So she was certainly one of his favorite actresses, but then he had many favorites and worked so well with people like Meryl Streep and Liza Minnelli and so many others, Jill Clayburgh, Candace Bergen, and so on.
Yeah.
He was known as an actress's director, which I think he was, but I think that sort of, in some sense, is unfair because he also elicited great performances from people like Kevin Kline and Harrison Ford. So he certainly worked very well with men as well.
Yeah, but it's a versatility that is pretty rare among directors, that he's equally good at crafting these terrific original performances for women,
mm-hmm.
as he is for men. In terms of the parallax view, was that well received at the time of its release, and do you sense that it's kind of resurging somehow?
Well, let me give you a more complicated answer than you might be looking for, but all of his early films that are now regarded as classics, Clute would be one, To Kill a Mockingbird would be another, and The Parallax View certainly another, were not really given very good reviews at the time of their original release. Afterwards, critics began changing their minds and saying that Clute was a masterwork, but that's not the way people originally thought about it, and they didn't feel that way in general about The Parallax View either.
That's true.
Yeah. So there was a real sea change. What caused the sea change?
Yes.
I think the fact that, for one thing, audiences were clearly appreciative of the work, and it made critics take a second look. And it may just be the fact that the critics themselves, you know, felt they had to go back and see what made these pictures so appealing. You know, this is not a Pakula picture, of course, but a similar kind of event happened with Bonnie and Clyde when it came out in the 60s.
Right.
You know, it got terrible reviews when it was first released. And it was considered to be an exploitative movie and not one that would have much interest for anybody. But,
right.
Of course, it very shortly afterward became known as a masterpiece, and I think it genuinely is a masterpiece.
I agree. What about Taxi Driver? That also was one of those cases that was not widely praised like it is now.
Yeah, I guess that's true. I really don't recall what the original response to Taxi Driver was, but, you know, you could go back even to, I mentioned Chekhov before as the playwright that Pakula directed when he was in college, but Chekhov's plays, which are now considered among the best plays ever written,
mm-hmm.
right?
I think maybe he is Shakespeare among playwrights.
Right.
But
right.
When his plays were first done in the 1890s, they were just torn apart by the critics because Chekhov was so very different. He was so far ahead of his time, and people
didn't
have any understanding of what he was doing.
It seems I discovered The Parallax View a few years ago, and I, being a film lover, I had no idea it existed. I was just taken aback. It was just a jewel of a movie, and I said, "Where's this been?"
Yeah.
So in my personal universe, it really opened my eyes to a great new movie, and it got me very excited. But All the President's Men, it seems that Robert Redford must have been an ideal collaborator for Pakula.
They worked extremely well together. They had their arguments. Redford was essentially the producer, although he didn't take the credit as producer on the film. And, of course, Pakula was the director. But they collaborated on almost everything, including the script, because they really didn't like the original script that had been written for the film. And so they locked themselves in a hotel room for about 5 or 6 weeks and rewrote it virtually line by line, according to Redford. So the script, although it's credited to someone else who won an Academy Award for it, was actually written primarily by Redford and Pakula. And although, as I say, they occasionally had their differences, in general, the relationship was a really sound one and worked very well for both men.
And I think when you first see all the President's Men, it's so engaging, and I see a lot of it in the recent film Zodiac as well, in that it makes an observation of just people working and oftentimes doing the most mundane kind of activities. It makes that so engaging and thrilling in a way.
Yeah, I think that's one of the great triumphs of the film, that you would think that people going through call slips at the Library of Congress would be the dullest thing in the world to film, but actually it's an exciting moment. You would think that somebody, a reporter, calling his sources and all you see is the reporter, you don't even see the source,
right,
would be boring, but it's not at all boring. It is, in fact, very exciting. And a lot of that has to be attributed to Redford. He was excellent, I think, in that. I've always felt that Redford has always been underestimated as an actor, but especially
so.
In that picture, he's really outstanding, I think.
It's fantastic. And this is, you mentioned the Library of Congress scene. This is where oftentimes I've read past reviews, and they review Pakula's direction as workmanlike, which almost seems like a backhanded insult in a way.
But
it's because his style doesn't call attention to itself, but there's an enormous amount of style in All the President's Men that completely is motivated and driven by character. And that library scene is a prime example. That crane shot that kind of hovers further and further away as they're buried in a mound of information there over their heads. And scenes where they're on the telephone and they have just an exceptional split focus, and there's so much in that movie to relish for me.
Yeah. And if you started going through it, you can talk about the sound in that picture, for instance,
yes,
at the very beginning when the typewriter keys are striking the paper, and there are gunshots mixed in with that. And whips to make the sound that much more arresting. And these are all, of course, choices that Pakula would make in the editing room. But if you were to characterize his style, I would say it would be a style of restraint in which the director really doesn't get in the way. And you're not so much conscious of the director when you're watching the picture. What you are conscious of is following characters in a plot that's being developed and resolved.
Yeah.
So I think a restraint is probably the best word to characterize his approach.
What do you think his legacy is and will continue to be?
Well, good question. The movie business, I think, has changed a lot since he was part of it. I do think that at the time that he was most prominent, films were a much more mature medium than television. And he took advantage of that possibility of working in a mature medium and making mature statements and films. I think that the movies may not have maintained that any longer, and I'm sure I don't think that television is any longer to be looked down upon.
Mm-hmm.
There's some good and serious work being done on television, too. So I don't know. I think the jury is still out, maybe. I hope that his legacy is that it's possible to direct personal films and also to be a good businessman and, you know, to try to bring in a profit for the studio that's distributing the picture, but primarily to direct films that are personal to the director and in which the director has that kind of personal investment. I hope that turns out to be the case, but I guess we'll just have to wait and see.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see. But as for me, I mean, I'm a 34-year-old guy from Florida, and he's really enriched my life with his work, and I just appreciate you coming on so much.
Yes.
and sharing your stories of him, and thank you so much, sir.
Yeah, I'm
thank
very
you
glad
very
to. Good to talk to you.
Thank you.
You too, sir.
Sure.
That is Jared Brown. His book is Alan J. Pakula, His Films and His Life. It is available now. Pick it up. Great insights. We even forgot to mention Harrison Ford does the foreword on the book. That's another collaborator of Fakula's. They did two films together, Presumed Innocent and The Devil's Own. Speaking of which, our next guest is the screenwriter of The Devil's Own. We'll get, and really a protege of Mr. Pakula's, and we'll get his insights, too, into this tremendous artist. It was good to hear from him.
Yes, it was. That was very informative. I also like when they bring up, you know, a lot of these films, you know, we do consider them classics, were not well received by the critics
yeah.
when they first came out. It's always something of a shock when you first hear that.
Yeah, and you know, it's strange because the one that we refer to as the ultimate classic now, which what is the top, you know, the AFI, the one top movie ever made?
Citizen Kane, isn't it?
Citizen Kane. And contrary to popular opinion, Citizen Kane was praised to the heavens upon its first release.
Right.
It was actually one of those cases where, yes, it was ahead of its time, but it was appreciated
yes.
at that time.
You could still do that, I mean, because it was such a new medium then that you could still, and that year that came out, so many great films came out, but yeah, I mean, it's amazing. It was a groundbreaking film in a relatively new art form, but yeah, I wonder what that would, if that would be, how that would be received today. I'm always curious about some of these films, like Lawrence of Arabia, how they would be received today.
Yeah, and maybe it's just my small universe where I just recently, in recent years, discovered Parallax View. Maybe that's why I feel like it's going through a resurgence of interest.
I'll be very honest with you about that movie. Long before we had cable, I'd watched that on one of this, our local channels, and God, this must have been the mid-late 80s, and it really blew me away. I do think that was one of the first films, I guess you could say maybe, well, obviously not the original Manchurian Candidate, but that and later Winter Kills. It really took
right.
a fictional look, but at the Kennedy assassination.
And Manchurian itself went through a resurgence, and you still hear a lot of people talking about 3 Days of the Condor, which
Three
is...
3 Days of the Condor is a superb film, mm-hmm. and timeless, I would have to say.
Yeah, like,
and it's
so
been imitated so much in the last year. There are certain, in the last couple of years, there are two movies I can think of that owe a lot to it. But
you know, we talk a lot about 70s cinema, or at least I do. And obviously, it's a wealth of such timeless films that came out of the 70s.
Right.
There's great movies that come out now as well. I don't want to say that the only time any good movies ever came out were 30 years ago. But it was really marked by the political, socially conscious films, of which Pakula was a leader.
Right.
With that Paranoid trilogy alone, what they refer to as the Paranoid trilogy. I mean, he was it. I mean, he was like the godfather of that genre movie in the 70s.
No, he took it to new heights. You could make the argument that Samuel Fuller was doing it with some of his films, his crime films especially. Actually, a lot of the gangster and a lot of the film noir did attack these themes. But Sidney Pollack, forgive me because you brought up 3 Days of the Condor, but Alan J. Pakula was the first one to really the conspiracy theory and put it into a mainstream narrative.
Right.
And it worked very well.
Yeah, and All the President's Men is, for me, it's just one of those perfect movies.
Oh, well, look to it, like Zodiac and also Traffic.
Yeah.
The influence is seen so much.
Yeah, and I read interviews with filmmakers like Soderbergh that says, you know, I was heavily influenced by All the President's Men. And that style that he was referring to earlier, Jared Brown, it's not intrusive, but it brings out the most of the character and the setting and the theme of that story. And that's something that we're lacking today, too. We have
right.
so many show-off kind of directors, and it's fun to see all the pyrotechnics and that kind of thing, but does it serve the story, you know? Does it serve the characters?
It just depends. I mean, it just depends on your point of view, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Are you ready to continue this? This is great.
Yes, yeah.
We continue our celebration with David Aaron Cohn, an exceptionally talented screenwriter
who regards Alan J. Pakula as his mentor in the film business. In addition to scripting Pakula's last film, The Devil's Own, Mr. Cohen has also written films like V.I. Warshawski, Point of View, Friday Night Lights, fantastic movie, and the television miniseries 5 Days to Midnight. It is a great pleasure to welcome David Aaron Cohen to Movie Geeks United. David, are you with us?
I am. Hey, glad to be
here. Hey, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Tell me first, what was your introduction to Pakula in terms of the first film of his that really took hold of you and had an impact on you?
Actually, the first movie of Alan's that influenced me quite a bit was Clute, which I saw, you know, I think I was probably in high school at the time and just went to the movies. And it was one of those movies that really got me started thinking about film as a career. I just went, you know, wow, if you can make a movie like that that has that kind of power. And it was so understated, and the performances mm-hmm. were just great. It was just great cinema, you know. And so it was kind of a great adventure many, many years later to be walking into his suite at the Four Seasons when he came to Los Angeles, and he was looking for a writer for this project, for this book that he had optioned called Friday Night Lights. And, you know, so it was kind of a long story, but I got the opportunity to walk in and audition for that job. He was meeting with maybe 6 or 7 kind of A-list writers in Hollywood, and I was, you know, the new kid. And we met, and, you know, I sort of walked into this hotel room, and Alan, as was his practice, I don't know if you know this or anyone's spoken about it, but he used to direct all of his movies in his socks. He didn't wear shoes on the set. And I think that was part of his just, I don't know, there was something about, you know, I've said this a lot about Alan, but he had a kind of childlike quality to him, in the best sense of the word, that he was just really curious and,
yeah.
you know, wide-eyed and comfortable with himself in that level. And here I was in the Four Seasons, and he shuffled in his socks, and we had this... this meeting, and I kind of pitched my take on what I saw in this material and what kind of a movie it would be, and walked out the door, you know, didn't think I'd ever hear from him again. And about 3 weeks later, I was in my office in the backyard of my house in Venice, and I get this phone call. It just, like, passed right through. And Alan had this way of talking. He would kind of, he would sort of mumble and talk, and he'd be ahead of himself, get ahead of himself in the conversation. And he was like, so when are you coming to New York? You know, and I was like, I didn't even know that I'd gotten the job. You know, that was how it started. So about a week later, I was on a plane to New York, and ended up being one of 3 scripts that I wrote for him. So.
Wow. So, but the original meeting was for Friday Night Lights.
Absolutely, yeah.
And Friday Night Lights was to be his follow-up to The Devil's Own?
No. I mean, the timing of this is all different, you know, because as it is in the movie business, one movie comes out, you know, can end up coming out much later than the other one. So
right.
Friday Night Lights was, I first started working on it for Alan back in 1991 or 92. It had a long
wow.
gestation period. And once I finished that draft, you know, he kind of kept getting caught up in other projects. And I think, to be honest, it was a piece of material that he really liked a lot. And again, Alan had a great eye for literary material. You know,
right.
he did a lot of adaptations and, you know, movies like Sophie's Choice or All the President's Men. And so he saw, you know, the possibility and the potential in this material. Whether or not it was really a movie that, you know, he was intending to direct at some point, you know, I think the answer to that question is that actually at the end of the day, he realized that it wasn't, you know, for him. But he was a great producer. You know, that's a lot of things, something that people don't recognize him for so much. And he was a producer for years before he even directed a film.
Oh yeah, we've been discussing those efforts. I mean, you can't get better than To Kill a Mockingbird.
Yeah, exactly. I grew up in Chicago, so I was a White Sox fan. So I remember seeing Fear Strikes Out,
right?
The Jimmy Pearsall story, you know, about a major leaguer who, I don't know if you guys talked about it, who has a little bout with mental illness. But yeah, so.
So tell me about that relationship, because you kind of regard him as a mentor to you in the business.
Yeah, well, he really gave me my first big break in you know, in hiring me. really, I didn't have the sort of credentials or, you know, the list of or even scripts to read that were appropriate to that story when he met me. But he had read a spec script that I wrote, you know, at the time I'd already done the I, Warshawski. And again, it was just him. He was that kind of person who really, when he met someone and he believed in your talent, you know, he was a big broker for people of giving them, you know, that opportunity. And so that's how, you know, that's really how we got started. And after I finished Friday Night Lights, he had then also optioned another book, which I loved, and it was just an adaptation that was really, really challenging, with Jonathan Leeson's book, A Gun with Occasional Music. I don't know if you guys
Yes.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah, it was just a great, you know, it was like sci-fi, noir, you know, detective. It had all the genres kind of affecting. It was a really challenging piece of work, but it was...
Yes, it is.
Yeah. And, you know, I wrote it. I did a couple of drafts for Alan. And again, in that process, that's really of going through, you know, writing two scripts like that with him, somebody who was really actively mentoring me, because in working on a script with him, you just had that opportunity to go to work, you know, to roll up your sleeves and go to work. And what that meant in Alan's terms were I would fly out to New York and we would schedule these sessions where I would sit in his offices in New York and we would just brainstorm, you know, and it was a wonderful, wonderful process with him. I think one of the things that he really taught me was how to create a space where all the ideas were welcome. You know what I mean? It didn't matter how silly they were or how stupid or how outrageous or how banal, whatever it was, there was no idea that wasn't welcomed in that space, you know. And it really helped me to learn how to break story. And it's not something you necessarily learn in a lot of other places in the film world.
In terms of story, story construction, and working with him on that, were there elements that he gravitated to, and some things that he wanted you to try to avoid at all costs?
I think Alan, in many ways, he was a classicist. You know, he really, I don't know what else you guys have covered in the interview, but he had this incredible understanding, I think, of film grammar. When you watch him as a director, when you watch his work, it's just, you know, you just marvel at the shot selection, at the places where he puts the camera, at the way the economy of means, you know,
right,
the way that he really communicates. And I think if you think about it, if you think about film grammar and using each shot, medium, close, wide, you know, as parts of speech, you see also, because Alan was a writer also, you know, he wrote a lot of his own stuff. He did the script for Sophie's Choice, you know. And so he thought like a writer in many ways. And when you work with him on a script, it would also just be about really honing in and just telling the essentials, you know, in any scene. And one of the things that I've passed that on to other writer friends of mine, even to my own children now who, you know, are writing their papers for school, is that he would write in the margins. He would have his pen and he would write in the margins on a piece of dialogue or a piece of whatever, NGE. Which was not good enough, you know. It was an Alan thing, because he didn't want to, you know, he wasn't big on confrontation, you know, he wasn't like a scream or anything like that, but it was the way that he would push you to do your best. You know, you'd look at it, and afterwards, I would see that NGE, and I'd go, you know what, he's absolutely right. It's okay, but it's just not good enough.
Right. So did you have an opportunity to speak to him about his own work and get a sense of what he felt about his previous work?
You know, with Alan, when you talk about his own work, he was a great storyteller too, and he would tell, you know, all the stories about this production and, you know, that movie star and, you know,
right,
what happened. He was a great gossip too, I have to say. He loved to gossip, Alan. So we didn't get, I mean, there were certain things that, you know, that he would tell us about. Like one of the things was how he shot Parallax View really without a script, like that was ready before they went into production.
Oh.
And it was very much kind of guerrilla filmmaking in that sense. And, you know, I remember hearing that and then thinking about when I saw that movie, because I think it's one of the great conspiracy films of all time.
I do too. I do too.
Absolutely.
You know, and really underappreciated movie. I mean, it's just so, it was so groundbreaking in so many ways.
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah.
So I remember thinking about that and going, you know, to be able to pull that off, and to have that kind of vision and to do it on the run, you know, the way they were doing that in the 70s, kind of running through New York City and other parts of the country, it's just my hat, you know, absolutely off to him about that.
Do you get a sense of what he? This might be too broad of a question because mm-hmm. there are so many versatile films in his resume, but of what he wanted to say or what he wanted to express with his work.
It's a good question.
Or the themes that kind of that kind of consumed him.
Yeah, I think ultimately Alan was very much, you know, he was a humanist. You know, he really believed in both the potential and the abilities of human beings to shape their own world. You know, and if you look at some of the stories that he told that I think resonated the most, they really got down to, you know, how each of these characters, what kind of choices they made in their lives. Alan was not a guy who was, you know, he wasn't, there was no big religious side to him or that, just the opposite. You know, he came out of New York, the sort of New York intellectual world, you know, where psychoanalysis was a very big item.
Right.
And people's psychological motives were really the things that consumed him. And he was a great observer of people in that sense. So I think if you look at his movies, you look at the things that really were active in the storytelling, they are about, you know, why human beings make the choices they do, understanding to the depths of, you know, your ability as a storyteller and putting it up on the screen, the kind of choices they made. You know, obviously with that word, Sophie's Choice comes to mind because it was that kind of a story. But even in some of the other movies, you know, with Jane Fonda and that whole relationship and Clute and what she's looking to choose and not choose and the moral choices of the politicians and Parallax View.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even if you look at Devil's Own, it's really a movie also about, you know, those kind of choices. You know, are you making that choice, that sort of human choice of relationship versus the choice of politics, you know, for let's say Brad Pitt's character and, you know, as an IRA terrorist. So I think you just... you really care deeply about people and about his characters, and I think it shows in the work that he did on the screen.
I definitely want to get to The Devil's Own, but I asked this of the previous guest, Mr. Pakula's biographer, Jared Brown.
Mm-hmm.
If, you know, his films in the 70s, I mean, those were the types of movies that audiences kind of ran to in the 70s, the social consciousness films.
Sure.
And then we've kind of strayed away from that. Did you get a sense from him of what he thought about the direction movies were taking after the 70s?
You know, I think he knew that age had passed in its own way. And I say it passed not in the sense that people aren't making, you know, important, groundbreaking guerrilla films nowadays. It's just, I think maybe more accurately, for himself, that age had passed. He wasn't gonna go out and do movies on that level. He was gonna work very much within the studio system.
Yeah.
And you know, and he had a really good arrangement, I think, with the studio system until, like, for so many people, you know, the names changed and were replaced by the conglomerates and the multinationals, and then all of a sudden, you know, the landscape was different. You know, and then he found himself more able to make movies like Pelican Brief or Devil's Own, you know, as sort of bigger pieces of popular entertainment.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So I think, you know, I can tell one story that might, you know, reveal a little bit about that, and that was, there was a time when I was coming out to New York, we were working on, I'm trying to think, I think it was probably working on at the time on the script for Gun with Occasional Music, and he was going into pre-production on a movie. It was... Consenting Adults.
Yes.
Right. And again, at best, you know, it was a B movie. I mean, just from the get-go, you know,
right,
kind of what it was. And I just asked him, I said, Alan, you know, you can really, it's not like you need the money. You know, you could choose whatever. You know, why are you making this movie right now? And his answer, it really stayed with me. He said, you know what, I just am practicing my craft.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
interesting.
Me,
okay.
You know, that was a great answer because it was like, so what if, you know, it wasn't going to be the Oscar movie or wasn't going to be whatever. He was a craftsman. He was a consummate craftsman. And the opportunity to practice, you know, was something that he relished. And, you know, that was something he got up in the morning to do.
Absolutely, and talk about a director that loves actors. He got to practice his craft with Kevin Spacey and Kevin Kline and Forest Whitaker, and you know it's a
sure Meryl,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
Redford, all those guys. Yeah, he was a great director of movie stars. He did.
Did you observe him on the set with actors, and what was that collaboration like?
You know, I had less of an experience with him on the set with actors, and more of an experience with him in the rooms before, because the whole experience of Devil's Own was one of intense actor issues.
Right, that's right.
So, you know, I was at the time, I ended up collaborating with Vincent Patrick on that script, and we were brought in. I was came to do a sort of page one rewrite of a movie that was already in pre-production.
Mm.
Yeah. That must have been stressful.
It was very stressful, but you know, the good news was that at first I thought I was doing it myself, and then they said, no, there's too much work. You have to partner with someone. And I had never really collaborated before as a writer, and they brought Vince in, and we just became great, great friends. And you know, we really held on to each other in the stressful events of the next 4 or 5 months of getting that movie made. But and it was also incredibly fun and entertaining, and you know, a zillion stories, some of which I can't repeat. But
that's a shame. I was hoping you could.
You could say you could. This is uncensored radio. You could say whatever you'd like.
Yeah, please.
Yeah, yeah. But it was a real, eye-opening experience to see, you know, Alan work in the rooms, because the way that it worked was, you know, this was a movie that had been originally set up with Brad Pitt. You know, it was like a one-hander. He was like the main star, that kind of thing. And then at some point, he had sent a script out, or somebody in his company had sent a script out to Harrison, thinking that he would play this part, you know, of the New York City cop. And when the answer came back, yes, you know, this was at the time, it was Columbia, it was Peter Guber, those guys, and all of a sudden, they got, you know, it was just so irresistible to the studios, the idea that they could have Brad Pitt, who at the time was, you know, the youngest huge movie star on the rise. Kind of every one of his movies had opened incredibly well.
Yeah.
And, you know, and here was Harrison, you know, who was Harrison. And then they immediately, all of a sudden, made the deal. And there was Harrison as the guy who had gone out to play the secondary role, signing the deal and, you know, getting paid $20 million. To play his part. And so the script all of a sudden needed some serious, you know, rewriting.
Right.
Because they were going to be damned if they were going to pay Harrison $20 million to play this cop who, like, drops his gun in the middle of a chase. And, you know, he was kind of a...
that's true.
So that's what happened. So Kevin Jarrow had written the original script, kind of wasn't going to move from where he had originally done it to, and Alan called me up. He said, you know, come to New York and let's see if we can go to work on this. And,
did you get a sense that he was satisfied with the final product of The Devil's Own, Pakula?
The way that it came out ultimately?
Yeah.
He was proud of it, and I'm proud of it too. I think it's, you know, if you watch it again, it's a movie that, you know, the story sort of off screen took over more for what was actually happening on screen. In terms
yes.
of people's perception of the film.
Right.
But when it came out, I remember reading one of the reviews, it was like the Time Magazine review, was, you know, for all the talk about what happened, you know, this is like a really good piece of filmmaking, you know. It was just, it was really well done in the same way that, you know, Alan was just a professional like that, and he got the good performances, and, you know, it was a difficult challenge just to write a movie in which you have two more or less equal main parts. It defies all the logic of, you know, conventional storytelling.
Yes.
So that was a challenge. And then it was also a challenge, you know, behind the scenes, because we had, you know, Harrison kind of coming in, and we got hired, Vince and I, really to rework the script so that it would give his part, make his part, you know, much, much bigger. And ultimately, mm-hmm. you know, that really irked Brad, so. So that's what happened. So all of a sudden it became a kind of a competition where we were perceived as, you know, Harrison's writers, and then we got really close to them, you know, the production, the start date, and it was kind of like, I remember the start, it was one of those moments that was like, you know, when they have they all go into the room to elect the next pope and you wait for the smoke to come out?
Right, right.
That was this meeting, you know. It was Harrison, Brad, Alan, and Larry Gordon kind of all sitting in a room and figuring out if they were going to actually make this or not. And this was after, you know, everybody had already been on salary for weeks and weeks and weeks, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, the DPs and everybody. And basically what Vinny and I would do is that every night we would write pages, and the minute that we would write those pages, like five or six pages, they would get taken down to the production. Then they would get distributed. Then the you know, everybody in the production design, everyone figured out, okay, because they were trying to figure out where the movie was going. This is like November when they're talking about shooting in January, you know. And we never really got to the place where we got to kind of write the entire draft before they started shooting.
Mm.
We were doing like five pages at a time, another five, okay, we got through act one, we got through half, you know, and we kept revising the other things. And we eventually got them all done, but it was, you know, it was very, very stressful.
I bet. But at the same time, I mean, Harrison Ford, this was the second movie he did with Pakula, and that the first, Presumed Innocent, I think, among his two or three best performances.
Oh, great. Yeah.
Yeah.
Harrison did a great job in Devil's Own. I thought they both were good, to be honest.
Yes, they are fantastic in Devil's Own, absolutely.
And Harrison was so much fun to work with, and just, he really was, you know. He's one of the funniest guys in the world when you meet him. He's incredible sense of humor. It's just so funny that he spent a career playing guys who, well, that's not true. If you look at the Indiana Jones movies.
It works because of the humor. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, it does.
Yeah. Alan would have been going on 80 this year.
Yeah.
Do you ever look around?
Because he was 69, I think, when he died. And
yeah.
Was, I mean, when 97 we did Devil's Own. So
right.
Yeah.
Do you think about what his what kind of films that he'd be making today? I know that Jerry and I were talking about it, we were theorizing, and I thought, you know, there's a property, it's called Against All Enemies, and it's
Richard Clark's book.
Yeah, and I thought, man, that would have been Pakula's thing. That would have
mm-hmm.
been.
Yeah, yeah. You know, we used to joke because Alan's parents, you know, lived to be like 100 and 101, you know,
oh, wow.
And we were just always laughing about, you know, how long he was going to be able to keep working because he had incredible energy. I mean, I have to tell you, I was the youngest guy on that particular set, you know, of Devil's Own in terms of, like, because Vince is older and Larry Gordon and, you know, Alan at the time was maybe, I don't know, 66 or 7, something like that.
Right.
And he would just work us under the table, you know?
I have a feeling he would have worked till the end.
Yeah.
What's that?
He would have worked like John Huston, and he would have worked to the very end.
He would have been making movies. I mean, he would have made 10 more movies.
Yeah, I believe that.
Absolutely. I mean, it was just amazing. We'd be working on script pages. You know, we'd have meetings on it, like, after dinner, you know. And this is already when they started production. And he would get up, you know, 4:30, 5 o'clock. He'd be out there on the set in his socks, you know, ready to go. And I just was like, you know, I used to go, how do you do it, you know? Like, I wish, you know, I'm hoping that when I'm 67 years old, I can be doing those 20-hour days, doing something that I love. And I think that's exactly the reason why, because he just loved what he did.
You let Haldeman slip away.
Yes.
You've done worse than let Haldeman slip away, get people feeling sorry for him. I didn't think that was possible. In a conspiracy like this, you build from the outer edges and you go step by step. If you shoot too high and miss, everybody feels more secure. You put the investigation back months.
Yes, we know that. And if we're wrong, we're resigning. Were we wrong?
You'll have to find that out, won't you?
Listen, I'm tired of your chicken shit games. I don't want hints. I need to know what you know.